Here's to the great American settlers. The millions of you who settled for unsatisfying jobs because they pay the bills. Of course, there is something else you could do if you got something to say. Start a podcast with Spreaker from iHeart and unleash your creative freedom. Maybe even earn enough money to one day tell your old boss, "Hey, I'm no settler. I'm an explorer." Spreaker.com. S-P-R-E-A-K-E-R. Hustle on over today.
BetMGM is pitching baseball fans a chance to swing for the fences. Register using code CHAMPION200 and win $200 in free bets when you place a $10 moneyline wager on any Major League Baseball game and either team hits a home run, regardless of your bet's outcome. Enjoy baseball like never before with BetMGM's daily promotions at your fingertips all season long. Download the app or go to BetMGM.com and use code CHAMPION200 to win $200 when you bet $10 on an MLB game and either team hits a home run. Sign up today and find out why nothing beats a win at the King of Sportsbooks. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. Must be 21 years of age or older to wager. Virginia only. New customer offer. All promotions are subject to qualification and eligibility requirements. Rewards issued as non-withdrawable free bets or site credit. Free bets expire 7 days from issuance. Please gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-888-532-3500.
What is up, movie friends? Welcome back to Raiders of the Lost Podcast. I'm Anthony.
And I'm James, and this is episode 55. We're going to be doing some modern sci-fi films. This is like part two to this little series we have going on. In this episode, we're going to be doing Arrival, District 9, Looper, and Source Code. And Source Code we've talked about a little bit before in our Jake Gyllenhaal episode, but we're going to go more in-depth on the themes and the filmmaking process of that movie.
Yeah, and these are some of my favorite sci-fi films of the century so far. They're all fantastic. A few got Oscar nominations, and they're all very different from one another. They ask questions about different ideas of technology and science and simulation and futurism and time travel. So they tackle different themes and ideas, which I really like. So it's a very varied list of stories that we're going to talk about.
I love sci-fi films, and I think Arrival is probably the best of all four of these movies. I think Arrival is probably a masterpiece, a borderline masterpiece, just like Denis, all of his films are like that. And it's a really complex film that really dives more than just aliens coming to Earth. And then District 9 also has aliens coming to Earth, but in a different way and similar themes, but in a different style, where that's more about the apartheid and segregation and social classism throughout the world. And then Source Code, very cool alternate reality film.
Simulations.
Yeah, directed by Duncan Jones, David Bowie's son. And then Looper, Rian Johnson. He's a very good director. I love Knives Out. I know a lot of people don't like The Last Jedi, but he's still a really good director. He made The Brothers, Bloom.
Brick.
And then Brick with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And Looper is just a really freaking cool movie, and I love it.
Yeah, this is an excellent list, and I'm excited to talk about it.
I can't
wait. Great directors, too. All these directors are just some of the top directors that are working today.
And again, very unique directors, too.
Yeah, and I think Source Code might be my favorite. I think it's a really brilliant movie, and it's so fun, and I think it's just a genius story. It's so great. But let's get into it. The first film on our episode is Arrival, which was directed by Denis Villeneuve and was released October 11th, 2016, written by Eric Hesserer. The film stars Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, and Forest Whitaker. This film grossed $203 million on a budget of $47 million. When 12 spacecrafts mysteriously appear around the globe, a renowned linguist is called in to attempt communication with the alien visitors. With the world's various militaries chomping at the bit for a conflict, she works to decipher the aliens' language and intentions, but finds their words altering the very substance of her thoughts.
Like I said, Arrival, near-perfect film, if not, it's a modern classic in the sci-fi genre. Borderline masterpiece, Denis Villeneuve, one of the best filmmakers working. I mean, if you saw Blade Runner 2049 and you're amped up for Dune, like, Enemy's amazing. Every movie this guy makes is phenomenal.
Well, he was on a huge streak because his first major big film was Incendies, which is a French-Canadian foreign film that came out, I think, 2009. And then after that, he literally made Enemy, Prisoners, This, and Blade Runner 2049, like back to back to back to back.
Insane.
This guy had an insane like unbelievable 6 years as a filmmaker.
His filmography is becoming one of the best of all time. I'm sure once he's done directing and, yeah, and retires, he's going to be known as one of the greatest directors to ever live.
Yeah.
But everything about Arrival to me is flawless. The performances from Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, Forrest Whitaker are all excellent. The cinematography by Bradford Young,
yeah,
who did Selma, amazing. This is a visually stunning movie.
And Bradford Young also shot Solo, and he helped create the new Star Wars aesthetic that you see in like Mandalorian and the other, what's the other Solo, Rogue One?
Yeah.
It's called shooting in the toe, which means you shoot it because they're shooting digital cameras, very sensitive now. So a lot of the new Star Wars shows and movies are very dark and very minimal lighting because he kind of began that with his filming of this movie in Solo. So he put his stamp on the new Star Wars texture and color.
Yeah, and the cinematography in this movie, it's just every shot is beautiful. These massive landscapes with just like the ships hovering, and the aesthetics are amazing. And then the music by Johan Johansson is phenomenal and eerie and dark, but also at times meditative. And he's gone too soon. Rest in peace, Johan, because he made some amazing scores, but I think this might be his best one.
Well, the thing with this score is it is brilliant, but the most famous piece of music in the movie isn't his. It's Max Richter's on, I can't remember what it's called, on the Something of Daylight or something. And they
at the end,
it's in the beginning, in the end. And unfortunately, Johan's score was so great, it wasn't allowed to be Oscar nominated because Max Richter's song was used so heavily in the film. It became if a different song is used too much in a movie, that composer who composed the rest of the music, they can't get nominated for anything. So it bumped him out of the category. But that song, Max Richter's song, especially at the emotional climax of this movie, it just gives you goosebumps every time you see it.
Yeah, and this movie, Arrival, is based on the novel Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang. And the novel is a little different, but they obviously adapted it for the film in different ways. And when I go to see a sci-fi film, I want to experience something I've never seen before. And whether it's similar to other movies, that's fine, but I want to see it done differently. Like we've seen the movies of aliens coming down to Earth. Obviously District 9 is a different example, but then like The Day the Earth Stood Still, I feel like The Day the Earth Stood Still wanted to be what Arrival became, because I think Arrival is the epitome of the best movie of aliens coming to Earth and trying to integrate somehow with humankind.
And you're talking about the original one in the 40s, not the Keanu one.
Both of them.
And so, yeah, you're right. It was a new approach to it. And also, it was a new approach to the idea of time travel, because time travel is ends up becoming one of the main themes of this movie, but it's not the time travel we're used to. It's a different kind of way of thinking about traveling through time mentally, and you're experiencing time because eventually throughout this film, as we watch more and as Amy Adams' character, Luis, learns more about the alien language, she learns that the alien language isn't held back by time, and it is a circle. And so the circle is the main theme of this movie, I think, and eventually gets to the point where as you learn this language like Luis does, the more you learn it, the more it's kind of like I think it alters her mind and her brain as she learns the language, because then once she starts learning the language, she begins experiencing what we think are flashbacks but are actually flash forwards to the future with her daughter. And so she is starting to experience time on a flat circle as well. And so she's not like traveling through time, but her lifetime is now a circle. It's not point A to point B. And so I think that's one of the main themes of the film, and it's a really interesting way to think about traveling through time, not physically, but in your mind and mentally.
Yeah. This episode of Raiders of the Lost Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, the leaders in men's below the waist grooming. Get 20% off your order and free shipping using coupon code Raiders of the Lost at checkout. Again, Raiders of the Lost at checkout for 20% off and free shipping year round from manscaped.com. Manscaped's been awesome. They've sent us literally every product they have. Their luxury lawnmower groomer is the best I've ever used.
It's awesome.
It's got a flashlight on it and it's waterproof. Who thought of this? What a genius, this guy. Manscaped, I don't know who you're paying. Your engineers, give them a bonus.
No more CVS clippers.
So guys, grooming's a part of life. Taking care of your body visually, aesthetically, and scent-wise is really important.
Girls appreciate it.
Yeah, girls really do appreciate it, and guys appreciate it too.
Yeah.
So use our coupon code Raiders of the Lost at checkout for 20% off and free shipping year-round at manscaped.com. Get it. Just a heads up, if you haven't seen this movie, there's going to be some spoilers, especially in this film, that you don't want to hear spoilers for this movie if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
And so what you're basically referring to is the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which basically means that if you learn and study a foreign language long enough, you basically rewire your brain and the way you think
physically,
to determine how you now you perceive the world differently. And because this language now determines how you think, and so as you said, as Dr. Banks, Louise learns more about this alien language, she begins to acquire the knowledge of how they think. And like you said, they experience time differently, more in a circle, rather than we're humans and we experience the present constantly. We're always in the present. We experience time linear. But as you can tell by just the language that they write with the ink, and it's circular too, and it's almost like a palindrome. It goes backwards and forwards. So mm-hmm.
And her daughter's name is Hannah, so
yeah,
it's a palindrome.
Yeah, that's a palindrome too. And then also, spoiler alert, The greatest thing I think about this film, obviously when we get to the climax and we start to understand everything, is the opening of this movie is of this woman, Louise, and her daughter. And her daughter's birth, and then her daughter's horrible sickness and disease and early death. And it's interesting because the first time you watch this, obviously we're human. Again, we're experiencing time linear, so we're thinking this movie experiences time the same way as us.
And so that means that we think that Luis's daughter died before the events of the film, so these are her thinking about flashbacks of her daughter.
And Denis does a really clever thing is when we finally see Louise later, like at the college, she mm-hmm. seems like distraught or cut off from the world. She doesn't even pay attention to the news broadcast. She seems hollow inside. And when the first time you watch this, you're like, it's because she's mourning the death of her child. But mm-hmm. what we've learned eventually is that, and she even says a couple lines, like she says, "Who is this child?" And these are like little hints that the beginning of the movie is actually the end, but also the other way around, because it's all a circle. So she hasn't had this child who she's having visions of yet. But as she learns that language, as she learns the alien language, that's why she's seeing these visions before she's even encountered the aliens.
Because she will encounter the aliens and she will learn the language. So her mind is already going to be – it's already predetermined that she's going to fall into this loop of a circle of time travel. And I think that because you're right. It's smart to point out how in her first scenes she seems very distant – and distraught, and I think it's because she's feeling the loss of her daughter, but she hasn't experienced it yet. But she's feeling those feelings and those emotions, even though it happens years down the line. So I think because she ends up becoming in a looped timeline with herself, she hasn't experienced these moments, but she's feeling the emotional aftermath of them.
And she also has another great line in the beginning of the film where she says, "I used to think that this was the beginning of your story. We're so bound by time." And so she, again, isn't really understanding yet what's going on.
Yeah. And I just want to say that I think Amy Adams is one of the best actors working right now. She's got 6 Oscar nominations, and she hasn't won yet, but she's, time and time again, she delivers amazing performances with very varied characters. She has so much range. And with this film, she carries it completely on her shoulders. Yes, the production is great. Cinematography, the supporting cast is good. But all in all, it's a very simple story with very minimal locations. And for the most part, the camera's on Amy Adams in a close-up. And you are watching her experience these events. And she's such a great actor where she can portray so much emotion just with her face without speaking. And you can tell, like, there's a lot going on in her head as the character, even though she's not saying anything. And I think that she's one of the greatest actors at portraying someone thinking and emoting without showing it off too much.
Yeah, she's very vulnerable in this film and has also a tenderness. But also, it's ironic that she points out, too, in the film that she's this renowned linguist and expert at language and communication, but she herself doesn't know how to communicate. It kind of reminds me of Sean in Good Will Hunting, where he's teaching psychology, and he says, he's like, "I teach this stuff, and I didn't say I know how to do it." And so she's a poor communicator in real life. And a lot of this film is about communication, and it's what links us. But what happens to that when those chains of communication break down? And we see that just in small circle situations where, you know, all these doctors and military personnel they can't get along, and they're fighting in these little rooms, and they're bickering and arguing. They're all going in different directions. And then we see it on a larger scale of all the countries eventually start to cut communication off from each other.
Yeah, and that becomes the main conflict of the movie, is because what ends up happening is every country is 12 pods have showed up in 12 major countries, and every country has to work together and communicate because they all got different bits of information, and all of the information from the 12 pods need to be put together for them to properly translate the message the aliens are trying to send them. And as tensions rise, because countries are always at butting heads, and communication is so difficult in the modern age, even with all this technology. Everyone becomes at danger, especially because a couple of the major countries, especially China, they threaten to attack the pods, and they sever their communications, not wanting to work with the Americans and the other countries. And so it becomes a major crisis, the lack of communication and the inability to empathize with other countries and other people to work together for one common goal.
The realism of this film.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It really keeps you on the edge of your seat the entire time. You're kind of like waiting on bated breath, scene after scene, trying to see what's going to happen next, because the plot to me makes logical sense. Like, it feels like it could happen, where if aliens came to Earth, if we had this crazy astronomical anomaly that, you know, where they come and visit us, and realistically, they don't look anything like us, these aliens, these heptapods, because I think that's one of the ultimate examples of hubris of mankind, is we think that aliens will look exactly like us, or they'll have limbs like us,
humanoid,
they'll think like us, they'll have eyes like us, where really you can obviously explore the idea that aliens most likely, like these aliens, have different senses that we can't even imagine. They're a different form of self-aware. These heptapods, you know, they're clearly similar in a way to octopi to me. Obviously the way they communicate with their tentacles and their hands and the ink blots. Which octopi are actually incredibly intelligent animals and believed to be one of the only other self-aware species on the planet Earth. And an interesting thing about octopi is most of their neurons are actually in their limbs, which actually reminds me of how these aliens kind of communicate
with
their limbs.
So their brains, brain function in their limbs?
Not technically brain function, but like a lot of their feelings are actually in their limbs. So like,
oh, cool.
Yeah, so that they feel a lot throughout their body. And I think... I don't know much about octopi. I'm just spitting the ball here.
It sounds like you do.
But these heptapods, we eventually learn, are in the way they communicate with those like tentacle like hands. We think that's their entire size, but then we eventually learn that they're enormous, six story tall beings. And again, that's just an example that we don't know what aliens would be like at all.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because when we first see them, we think they're small. And then they're gigantic. And also it makes sense when you see what they look like, and then you understand, oh, that's why the ship is shaped like that, because it has, I'm sure every story or level of that ship needs to be very tall to fit them in it. And I think I love the design of them, and I love the ink blot technology they use. It's like an organic way of communicating that's really fascinating. And the team actually created their own language with these ink blots, and they were actually like made sense, and they were really translatable. If you want to translate them into English or another language. So a lot of work went into making these designs, and they made over 100 very specific ink blot circles. And each circle is it's not like one word. Each circle can be several sentences or so. So like different patches of each circle, there's like a patch that means one word and then a patch that means like a phrase. So the circle connected, a complete circle is more than just like a sentence. It could be like a lot of phrases put together.
Yeah, I think it's really similar to like the Chinese language or Japanese languages.
Yeah.
And these aliens, they're actually, we learn, are a higher dimensional being that, again, they perceive time all at once and use future events to influence Luis's present. They're there for humans to help them, because at some point they'll need, humans will need their help to save their existence.
How did Christopher Nolan not write this movie?
I figured, yeah, seems like him. Seems like a Nolan movie.
But I really love Denis as a filmmaker. He like you said, he's one of the best working right now. And one of the strengths to his filmmaking, and it's really evident in this movie, is he like Nolan, he's very much all about practical effects and sets, no, like using as little CGI as possible, using as little green screen as possible. And especially with this film, that set inside of the spaceship, that's a real set they built in a studio. So they built this gigantic set. I think it was like as big as a football field. And that glass screen, the glass window where they communicate between with Abbott and Costello, that was real. And I think that tangibility adds so much realism to the film, because all the sets in Blade Runner 2049, those are all real. They really built them. And he believes that his actors give their best performances if they're not in front of a green screen. They're on the set, and also the cinematography can be as good as possible when you actually build the set and then you can light it, rather than doing a green screen. We'll like, okay, we'll computer enhance where the light will show up and stuff. But I think that building the sets for something like this worked out so well.
And basically the plot of the film is Banks and then Donnelly, who's played by Jeremy Renner here very effectively, their job is to research and understand this complex language of these aliens and try to communicate with them what they want, why they're there. But there are obviously situations we talked about earlier where all these nations have their own ship and they're using their own methods to communicate with the aliens. And for example, I think the Chinese method they're using is they're playing a win or lose game to communicate with them, which leads to them thinking that the aliens are there to try to destroy them.
Because, yeah, they get confused thinking they said weapon rather than tool.
When really, yeah. So Louise tries to explain that it means tool. It doesn't necessarily just mean weapon.
Yeah.
And in a way, this film isn't really about aliens at all. You think it's going to be about an alien invasion or a world war or the destruction of our planet, but really this film is about life. It's about, if you knew your life from beginning to end, would you live that life differently? Or what else, what would you do to change it if you would? And the thing with Louise that makes her such a profound character is she knows what's going to happen, and she knows that
it's tragic.
She knows that her daughter's going to live a horrible life of disease and sickness, and she's going to die young, and she has to go through that pain as well. And the father has to go through the pain as well, who we learn is Donnelly. But she still decides to relive that fate despite the pain that it causes.
Accept what you have, even if it's just a little bit. Accept the good that you have in your life, and just live your life to the best you can, and like accept the cards you're dealt, because Louise, knowing that's her daughter, she could make the decision to never have a relationship with Donnelly, but she doesn't. She just goes on with it. And also you can also argue that it's kind of like Tenet in a way, where everything's already going to happen. Her loop is predetermined and she's just experiencing it. And who knows? She could be any age at this time, because her mind is a circle. So she could have already experienced death, you know what I mean? But this is just like the moment we're seeing in her life, but her mind is on a loop. So it's not like she's going traveling up a hill. She's just moving in a circle. So you could give yourself a headache thinking about this stuff, but it's really fascinating, because I think that she is influenced by her future already before she even starts interpreting the language.
Yeah.
And the aliens are able to use this to help her find a way of pretty much saving humanity and allowing China to communicate with the rest of the countries by she makes that phone call with the Chinese leader and tells him that line that his dying wife said to him years before that only he knew, and that was a moment to convince him to change his plan. And so the heptapods, they know that they can influence her. And once she begins communicating with them, they know that she'll be able to use the future to control the past.
And a lot of people don't really understand why is Louise special? Why does she get the power of these aliens? It's because she's the only one to fully immerse herself in the alien language. Obviously, all these other countries are making strides in communication and translating some of the vocabulary and the symbolism of the aliens, but she's the only one that immersed herself in it completely, which is why she gets the power. And that's why she also is learning as she goes the power of this experiencing time in a circle. And like the phone call you just brought up where she doesn't even remember making the phone call. And she's like, I called you, didn't I?
Yeah.
And then, so it's a really fascinating concept of it's hard to describe and call it time travel. Amy Adams was Denis Villeneuve's first choice for Louise. She agreed to the role within 24 hours of receiving the script. Arrival, one of the best sci-fi films made this century. It's a masterpiece of Denis Villeneuve, one of the best of his career, and it's a very rewatchable movie.
100%.
After a long day of, you just want to get some, but your, our popular Casper Original Hybrid mattress is engineered for cool, comfortable sleep. Get a restful night's sleep with our Wave Hybrid mattress, providing more support than foam alone. Upgrade to the Wave Hybrid Snow mattress for a full night of cooler sleep, offering free contactless delivery and a risk-free 100-night trial. Discover the Casper difference at Casper.com and use code MUSIC100 for $100 off select mattresses. Exclusions apply.
This episode of Raiders of the Lost Podcast is sponsored by MoviePosters.com. Use our coupon code Raiders15 to get 15% off your order today. Don't get your movie posters on Amazon.com. I know it's free shipping, but the quality is awful. MoviePosters.com is high quality. They have every movie you can think of. They have all sorts of sizes, framing, backlighting, glass, lamination, whatever you want, they can do it. Use our awesome coupon code Raiders15 to get 15% off your order at movieposters.com. Again, Raiders15 to get 15% off movieposters.com. Next up, we have District 9, which came out in 2009, directed by Neil Blomkamp, written by Neil Blomkamp and Terry Tatchell. This film stars Charlton Copley, Jason Cope, Natalie Bolt, and Sylvain Strike. It had a budget of $30 million and a worldwide box office of $210 million. Violence ensues after an extraterrestrial race forced to live in slum-like conditions on Earth finds a kindred spirit and a government agent exposed to their biotechnology.
I really love this film because of its approach to the material, because like you said earlier, we've seen plenty of alien invasion movies, and it's all done in the same style, but Neil Blomkamp had a really great vision where he shot this film to be a documentary, and it's half the footage is interviews with people talking about the events of the film after the fact, which adds a lot of curiosity to what's going to happen to Vickis as the story's progressing, and I think it's a really brilliant way because it makes it feel real. When it's shot documentary style combined with the interviews, it makes it feel like these are real events. And I also really love how the aliens came in the 80s. They didn't just arrive like Arrival. They came decades before, and now the humans who control the land in South Africa where they landed, they're just doing whatever they can to keep them separate, but also like a place for them to be. And so it's been a problem for a long time in this world.
Yeah, so these aliens who were referred to as prawns, they're stranded on Earth while they were in transit to their home world, and they have comparative technology though years ahead of humans, and they have like unique biotechnology, which is really cool. It only works with their DNA, which is why MNU can't figure out how their weapons work or figure out how to use them. The prawns are much larger and stronger than humans, and the creature design is fascinating. They're like giant insect-like monsters, kind of like alien. It's really cool, and they're
reptilian
and,
kind of.
Yeah, and they're incredibly powerful. They're also very capable at surviving in these slums, although they're horrible conditions because, you know, as soon as they're able to live off like any kind of meat they can find, and they're addicted to cat food, which is funny but also sad at the same time, because I think this film has a lot of subliminal messages. Like, I think the cat food is a representation of drugs for these slum-like areas in the real world, but this film is and the entire movie is a giant allegory, really, for obviously apartheid in South Africa, which Neil, the director, grew up during, and this is an allegory, a metaphor for that, but also just the vast differences in drastic social classes of specific countries, and a lot of countries actually, but you know, there are many countries where the social class structure is drastically different in terms of like the upper class and lower class.
Yeah, because segregation is a main theme in this movie, and you see several signs throughout the film in the city in Johannesburg. Like, the signs will say no prawns allowed, and you'll see images of like the cartoon drawings of a prawn on signs. And I think the marketing campaign for this film was brilliant, because one of the main posters was a target board, in the shape of a prawn with target holes in it from gunshots. And so that poster showed that the aliens are here, but they're viewed as enemies and as like lesser than beings. Blend that with the actual segregation of the prawns in the slum of District 9, and it's a really powerful film. Like you said, it's a great allegory for those themes.
The sad thing is a lot of countries still have slums like this, and you know, these people, a lot of them were born into poverty, which they'll never be able to escape, or have fled their homelands from war or turmoil or just in bad situations, and then they're left in these horrible situations in these other countries dependent on them and dependent on, I think at first they explained that the humans were, you know, generous and helpful of the prawns at first, but then eventually decades pass and they're sick of it, and that's why they have this MNU organization, which is a weapons manufacturer. They're in charge of basically the eviction of these aliens, and you can kind of assume what they mean by eviction of these aliens.
The refugee crisis is still very relevant today. There are still millions of refugees throughout Asia and the Middle East and Eastern Europe, and especially there's 700,000 people have escaped Syria and Yemen because of civil war and famine, and so a lot of people, like hundreds of thousands of people, are literally stranded in camps in the desert outside of city lines because they aren't allowed into the city. And so countries will build these fenced off areas with just tents, and families live there for years, like with nowhere to go. So these issues, they're still relevant. And I don't think they'll never not be relevant.
Yeah. And again, this film is incredibly smart. It's a very unique action and has, like we've been talking about, a lot of deep meanings. And I think Neil Blomkamp is a very talented director, and he was originally tasked with making a Halo short film, and they were hoping that he could make the feature length film of that movie, which would have been amazing because
yeah,
I love Halo.
I remember they released the short film online. It was
on
sick.
YouTube. You can watch it. It's a 7-minute short. It's really cool, and it makes you wish the full movie was made, but I guess the studio execs hated what he did with it. But I had just watching. It's very cool. But he has this really unique style as a director where he kind of creates his own aesthetic of the world where he blends like a lot of these slum-like worlds with future technology like we see in Chappie, or we saw it in Elysium. So he has this unique vision, I think, of how he sees things.
Yeah, 100%. And his voice is clear. And I think that he has a love for the documentary style of cinematography, which he's used in all of his films so far because it adds the realism. And I think that his other two films, they're very good, but they weren't quite the caliber of this film. And I would like to I honestly would like to see him do something that's not set in like a slum environment, maybe dealing with different issues and themes, and maybe still technology-based, but a little different from these three, because I feel like his three films so far, they are very similar in tone and theme. Elysium was cool, but also same kind of thing. So I think for his fourth film, I'd really like to see him take a fresh approach to a new story.
I agree. But I do think his decision to choose Charlton Copley as the lead of this film, who was not an actor before the movie was made, I think it was really smart because, like we talk about, the first act and first half of this film is like this fake documentary style of filmmaking. And I think Charlton's, he's phenomenal in this movie, but his amateur style of acting, I think, and his unrecognizable face add so much to the aspect of it being a documentary that, like, you don't know who this guy is. He's not a movie star. You've never seen him on camera before. He's a good actor, but he still has amateurish qualities to his acting, but it makes it seem more real.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Charlton is, I love him. I think he's a great actor. He's really great in Old Boy. He's in Maleficent and The A-Team. He's been in a ton of stuff since this movie. And this was kind of like an unplanned accident because he was a TV producer in South Africa in his 20s, and then he actually hired Neil Blomkamp while he was a teenager to work as a graphic design artist for the TV studio he was running in. And they worked together for years, and Charlton was his boss for years. And then Neil Blomkamp made a short film about District 9, and he had Charlton act in it for a few small scenes as like a character like Vickis. And it worked out really well, and he cast him as the lead in the movie when they got funding from Peter Jackson, who loved the short. So this movie got made because of Peter Jackson. He saw the short, loved it, and gave them a lot of money to make the film. And I think that it's this crazy story of how Charlton and Neil Blomkamp, they had such a long working history, a small time, and then they made it big, and they have just their careers have just exploded since District 9.
So the film follows Vickis, played by Charlton, who works for this company that's basically trying to evict all these aliens from District 9, which is the slum area that they live in. And it's really sad to see what's happened to these aliens and how they're living and how they've had to be, how they forced to adapt to these conditions. And again, the cat food, which is kind of funny at first, but it really shows like – how humans exploit them with the cat food and get technology from them with the cat food and get answers. And I like to compare it to drugs on streets where, you know, we hear all these stories and read all these books and conspiracies of, you know, a lot of these drug syndicates are funded by the government organizations of different countries. So they're putting drugs on the streets to control their populations in a way. You can see that obviously is being done here in the slums with the cat food. And so Vikas, he's going through these slums, and the main turning point of the film is Vikas becomes exposed to this alien fuel, which infects him.
Yeah, and it's an amazing story because he goes through the physical transformation of turning into a prawn slowly by day by day, and eventually his arm is just full prawn. And it's a really fascinating take on the story, and I think that's why it works so well, because at first Vikas is kind of he's very inhumane to the prawns, and because he's like giving people a tour of District 9, of the slums, as he's like going house by house, and he's like talking to the aliens as if like they are inferior beings, and he has no respect for them. And then as he slowly begins turning into one, he realizes that they're not people, but they are beings too, and they have minds and souls themselves, and he becomes more empathetic towards them, and he becomes dependent on them because that alien Christopher ends up being an aide to him and an ally, and they develop a friendship, and it gets to the point where Vikas even risks his life to save Christopher from the enforcement.
Yeah, I think what Blomkamp is trying to say with this film and with the story of Vikas turning into a prawn is he's trying to say, imagine what it's like living in someone else's shoes, someone who lives in a place like this, who's had this difficult life. And, you know, most governments and societies, we treat our lowest class citizens like the prawns are treated in this movie in District 9. And by turning Vikas into a prawn, he's experiencing life in their shoes and their bodies as a refugee, as a member of the most disenfranchised population on Earth.
This episode is brought to you by ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. Enter ServiceNow. It puts AI to work for people, for employees, for developers, and even your customers, removing frustration and supercharging productivity. On our intelligent platform, AI isn't just a promise. It's happening today. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. To learn more, visit servicenow.com/AI for people.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Earth, the super poor, and in a way, ironically, through his transformation, and even once he's fully transformed into a prawn at the end of the film, Vikas becomes more human the less human he is.
Yeah,
and he also clings to that humanity still, though, by he leaves that metal flower out for his wife to find, so he becomes more human, I think, at the end of the movie.
Yeah, 100%. And this film makes exceptional use of practical footage with CGI. This is 2009, so CGI was a lot better, but it still wasn't like how it is right now. And Blomkamp, with a budget of only $30 million, he made some of the most impressive visuals you had seen, because he combined this high-concept sci-fi style with documentary footage style. And it brought that, even if the CGI doesn't look perfect, the handheld quality makes it more believable. You know what I mean? That makes you accept it more. And they were really smart about how they shot it, you know? It's not like, they keep the lighting very minimal and very naturalistic and very simple, and I think that helps with the CGI as well. But the prawns look fantastic. I think that it's a beautiful film, and I think the most iconic shot, I remember from the trailer when I first saw it, it shows a shot of people on a helicopter, and it shows the ship, the mothership above Earth, just in the background, and it looked so fantastic and so realistic, and it was a very powerful image, and I think that's one of the reasons that caught people's attention for this film.
Yeah, in the third act of the film, Vickis's goal changes to helping Christopher and his son escape, because Vickis, he's turning into a prawn, and Christopher hints at that they have technology on their mothership that can reverse what's going on to him and change him back into a human, but obviously he gets captured, and MNU just wants to experiment on Vickis because he's able to fire the guns, and they've been trying to get the biotech and weaponry working. But there's this great dilemma where Vickis wants to help Christopher for his own selfish needs, but he also asks Christopher if he helps him escape and he travels back to his home planet, what's going to happen then? Is there going to be a war? Because obviously Christopher is going to tell the prawn species or planet what they're being treated like on Earth. So how can you guarantee a war will not start? I wish this had a movie had a sequel to kind of explore that idea in a way, but it's also really fascinating that there's also a cool theory that so this fuel turns you into a prawn. What if all the prawns, that's not their actual original being? Maybe that's not their actual life form or bodies. Maybe they use this prawn fuel technology to change their bodies during space travel or some other reason.
Like an organic exosuit?
Yeah, kind of like that. So maybe that's not even what they look like, which is why would they even have technology that reverses the effect of the prawn suit and the prawn being? So maybe they don't even look like that. Maybe they look more like us if they had the technology done on themselves to reverse it.
That's a really cool point. I never thought about that. That's fascinating.
Just when I finish my to-do list.
We need more chips, Mom.
Honey, I need a lot of chicken.
Something else comes up. That's when I use Instacart to help get everything we need from BJ's Wholesale Club delivered right to our door in as fast as 1 hour. And then finally, I can relax.
Mom! I think we're out of toilet paper.
Time for another BJ's order. Download the Instacart app or visit instacart.com to get $10 off your first order using the code BJ's Wholesale 10. Offer valid for a limited time. Minimum order $35. Additional terms apply.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino online.
I was only playing for fun, so winning was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's favorite free online social casino. You too could have the chance to win life-changing cash prizes. Absolutely anybody could be like Mary. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and play for free now. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of the winner.
Yeah, because that makes sense, because why would the fuel cause that kind of effect on a human?
Yeah, and why would they have reverse technology for it?
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I think this movie, I would definitely be excited if they made a sequel to this. That's a fascinating area to explore for the film. But all in all, I think it has such powerful messages, and Blomkamp did it in such a great way with the tech, and it's hard to believe that this movie doesn't have a budget of $150 million. It's fantastic looking. It's great. And for a debut, I mean, you can't think of a better debut for this, because this movie became a pop culture phenomenon when it came out in 2009.
Yeah, very viral marketing campaigns.
Yeah, the marketing campaign was genius, and it was the rare occasion of a science fiction film getting nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture, because like we talked about on the Dark Knight podcast, after the Dark Knight got snubbed, the Oscars changed the number of nominees from anywhere between 5 and 10 nominees. And so I think this year in 2009, I think 9 films got nominated, and District 9 made the cut, whereas it probably wouldn't have made the cut if it was still a 5-only nominee category bracket.
If you like our podcast, the best thing you can do to support us is share us with your friends, your movie buddies, your family. We're growing mostly word of mouth. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts. Hit the notification bell so you know when new episodes are coming out. And becoming a patron on patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast, patrons get specific perks like personalized messages, personalized video messages, and top-tier patrons get a monthly shout-out on the podcast.
Next up, we have Looper, which was written and directed by Rian Johnson and released September 28th, 2012. This film stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bruce Willis, Emily Blunt, and Paul Dano. Looper grossed $176 million on a budget of $30 million.
In 2074, when the mob wants to get rid of someone, the target is sent into the past, where a hired gun awaits. Someone like Joe, who one day learns the mob wants to close the loop by sending back Joe's future self for assassination.
Like we said earlier, a lot of these films, they took the same things we had seen before, and they had new twists on it and new takes on it. And Looper had this really fresh take on the time travel genre in terms of the job of a looper. And I think it's a brilliant sci-fi film. It's so well made, so well acted. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, this solidified his status as a leading man in Hollywood. And also, I think this was Emily Blunt's, you could argue, biggest breakout, being the supporting actress in this film, because she was fantastic. She played a very strong female character. And Bruce Willis really brought it with this. You could argue this is his last great movie that he was in.
Yeah, I love this movie so much so that I bought it on Blu-ray the year it came out. And I think Rian Johnson's a great director, like I said earlier. Despite what everyone says of The Last Jedi, Looper is a phenomenally original film that blew me away. It's complex. It looks great. Rian and JGL are actually great friends, and he wrote this part specifically for Joe. And, you know, there are characteristics that he gave the character, like learning to speak French because JGL speaks French fluently. I think the concept of it is so freaking cool. By the mob takes care of their hits by sending them back in time, so there's no trace of the hit in the future world because of a tracking technology. It's almost impossible to make someone disappear. And obviously, we're dealing with time travel here, so there's going to be a lot of paradoxes, and sometimes the story might not make total sense, and you can argue that how is this possible if this happens? How is this possible if that happens? But I think what Rian Johnson does with the dialogue too is, multiple times he's like, don't talk about time travel to me. Let's just talk about something else because we'll be here all day talking about it.
Yeah, you could argue that Terminator is impossible, the story, the grandfather paradox. You know what I mean?
So same kind of thing.
You can't think about it too hard. You can just allow it to happen and just have fun with it, like this movie.
Yeah, he just kind of leaves it simple. Just, these are the rules. Let's not explain it too quickly. We send people back in time to be assassinated and killed, despite the paradoxes that could be involved in time travel.
What I really like about this movie in terms of the production design is that it's a sci-fi futuristic film set in the future. Not too far, but far enough. And I like how the world, it's neither dystopian and neither utopian. It's very much, it feels like our world. And I think that's what the future will be like. I don't think the changes are going to be that drastic 40 years from now. I don't think it's going to be so much different. Obviously, technologies will improve, but like, for example, Emily Blunt's character, she lives in a rural area of the city, of the state, and she still lives on a farm, and she lives a very simple life. So I think no matter how advanced technology gets, even 100 years from now, 200 years from now, there are still going to be areas of the country that are just still rural and very simple. And yeah, they might have cool pieces of technology, but it's not going to be like super sci-fi crazy tech, you know, because the country's so big. That technology, no matter how amazing it is, it's not going to spread everywhere. So there's going to be large areas of the world and of America that are still going to be very simple and crude in terms of technology.
Well, yeah, the entirety of the city and the technology, yeah, there's some advanced technology, but I mean, Joe drives like a 2008 Miata. Like,
yeah.
It's not like things have progressed greatly, like and exponentially, because it seems like the world has hit kind of like a plateau,
mm-hmm.
even though there's some new tech, and obviously we have these interesting ideas of these telekinetic powers where 10% of the population has developed telekinetic powers where mostly they can just balance a coin above their hand.
It's more like a social status thing now.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah.
But I'm going to point out real quick right now that the plot of Deadpool 2 is basically a ripoff of Looper. It's like really hard ripoff. It's like the same freaking movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is. It's Hollywood. But I just want to point that out, that Looper came up with these ideas first.
Yeah, because the fire kid in Deadpool 2, he's pretty much Rainmaker. The same character as the Rainmaker, the kid in this movie.
Yeah,
same exact story.
Same concept.
And then Josh Brolin is sent back to try and to kill him to save his family from dying. It's the same exact story.
But we gotta digress. It's Hollywood.
Yeah.
But I think the decision to use Joseph Gordon-Levitt's face with prosthetics, did it hurt or help the film or the character portrayal of the young Joe? I think it was a little weird at first, but you get used to it while you're watching the movie. But I would have not minded it at all if they didn't do any prosthetic work on Joseph Gordon-Levitt at all. I would have accepted it totally. I mean, they're different actors, so it may have been a little bit overkill. I think if you just learn the voice and the mannerisms of Bruce, which he did really well, you don't need the prosthetic work. But I think Rian Johnson just kind of wanted to give it an extra edge.
Yeah, it can go both ways. I agree with you. I don't think they had to do it, but I think it was, with what they did, it was fantastic. I mean, Joseph Gordon-Levitt wore prosthetics on his jaw, on his mouth, on his nose. And so I think they wanted to show that it really was him, because for those shots at the diner where they're both sitting at the table and you see the profile of them, because they even arched Joseph Gordon-Levitt's nose with prosthetics the same way that Bruce Willis's nose arches in a profile, and the lips the same lips. And so I think when you see them sitting together, having that coffee and talking, it really makes it feel like they are the same person. You know what I mean? So I understand they could have done it without it, but I think it was really cool how they did it, and it looked great. I like you said, it's weird at first because you know what Gordon Levitt looks like, but 5-10 minutes into the movie, you accept it, and you're like, okay, this is Joe in this movie. And in terms of the plot, I think it was really great because the antagonist of the movie is the protagonist. You know what I mean? It's you never seen that with time travel where the main character, the villain they're all going up against is themselves. And I thought it was a really exciting and refreshing way to tell this time travel story. And I adore that diner scene because when they first get together, you think the conversation might go well because they're the same person. They might want to like team up or something, but they end up being extremely antagonistic with one another, and their ideologies and their goals completely clash. So they really become their enemies in this movie. And I thought it was so cool to see the same person and enemies with themselves.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And we learned that although time travel is declared illegal once it's been discovered in the future, the mob and crime syndicates cheat and use it as a method for disposing of its enemies. And being a looper, it's a highly lucrative profession in this kind of impoverished new future world that they're living in, the distant future. But it also comes with the stipulation that once your time comes and your like looper career is over, you will be sent back for termination and you will be killed by yourself, which means closing your loop when you're the young version of yourself and you kill the old version of yourself. So the loopers never know when this is going to occur, when they're going to get sent back the old version of themselves. And the way the assassinations take place, it's really cool how they're just like standing there waiting and Joe's just like looking at the ticking clock, like listening to French translations in his ear, and then just suddenly someone appears screaming. And it's actually really a cool sequence where Rian Johnson takes you in like the day in the life of a looper or the week in the life of a looper.
So that's a great point. There are two really great montages in this movie, and I think that montages, they can be an important part of a movie. And so the first montage is that where you see what Joe's life is like being a looper, what he does for fun in his free time. He's a drug addict, he's a criminal, but he has friends, and he wants to move to Paris, and he also kills people as this assassin. And it's this great like 5-minute montage that really establishes the character in the world. And then the second montage, I think, is one of my favorite parts of the movie, where even though Joe's path is on this trajectory in the movie, Rian Johnson wisely shows us the older Joe's path and what happened to him after the moment in this film, which is like the deciding factor of him leaving the country and moving to China.
When he actually did close his loop.
Yeah, when he did close his loop in, because that's what the older Joe did. The Bruce Willis Joe closed his loop at this age and then just lived his life with whatever savings he had left. And I think it's a really amazing montage of seeing him age into his 50s. And even though he had a ton of money, he spent it all, became a drug addict, and he became a criminal again just to earn money. And then Bruce Willis's Joe, he's motivated by the loss of his wife who saved his life, and she became the most important person in his life. And after she is killed, that is the motivating factor for Bruce Willis's Joe to travel back in time and stop the Rainmaker when he's a child. And so Bruce Willis's character he does some really horrible things, and he acts up a storm in this. He does a really great job in this movie, especially like after he kills that kid and you see him like breaking down under the bridge. Bruce Willis's Joe does horrible things, but you can empathize with him because he's motivated to save the life of his wife and also to save the future from this Rainmaker villain.
Closing your loop, it's an odd situation to think about. Like, you kill your older self, then you get this huge payday. I'm sure it's a really weird feeling. I mean, obviously they all celebrate and they live their life because they've closed their loop and they basically have an early retirement and they get to enjoy the next couple decades of their life until it's time to go back in time and be murdered. And would you kill an older version of yourself? I mean, if it's part of your destiny, what difference does it really make? But also factor in that traveling through time, it creates different realities and different paradoxes. And so you're really killing the current version of your young self, or are you killing a different version of yourself that's been sent into this timeline, or the future version of an alternate you? And again, you don't want to spend too much time thinking about the paradoxes of this film and everything. And it's almost kind of like not taking care of your body or overindulging in abusive substances at a young age, where at the time it's awesome and it's fun and you're having a good time, but you're not thinking about what your body's going to be like in 40 years because of this and the damage you're doing.
Yeah, and this movie has a great twist. I mean, obviously you can tell it coming when we learn that the Rainmaker from Bruce Willis's Joe's World is actually Sid, the little boy who lives on the farm, and we slowly see hints and reveals of his immense power in TK. And it's really fascinating because this kid is destined to become the Rainmaker, but we don't know how, because his mother seems to be a mother who really loves him. So it's kind of curious, like, you're wondering, how does he become such a horrible monster? And then Joe understands that the Bruce Willis Joe, and by coming back in time to kill Sid as a child, he will fail and eventually will create the Rainmaker because it will kill his mother in the process. And so then he knows that he has to sacrifice himself in order to save this young boy and stop himself from doing it. And it's a really powerful climax to the film, and I was very moved by it. And when Joe turns the blunderbuss on himself, you're like, no, but he had to do it.
Yeah, but this film has a lot of great ideas too, of like, obviously older Joe survives the assassination and killing by the younger Joe, and we have two Joes in the same timeline, in the same era, because he failed to kill his Lupin. Earlier in the film, Seth, who's played by Paul Dano, he fails to kill his Lupin. Joe hides his friend Seth and eventually gives him up, though. But one of the most disturbing scenes of the film is the older version, Seth, running away and trying to catch that train, but then his limbs and fingers start to disappear.
Oh, I love that
scene.
So
it's really disturbing to watch each finger, and then they start...
Then his nose.
Then his nose, then his limbs, and he's eventually crawling back to the criminals to stop cutting off Seth's limbs. But again, this introduces the paradox of how could Seth become a looper or continue his life if his limbs are being cut off?
Yeah, so, like, he would have never been able to come back.
So again, there are examples of this paradox, but you just got to kind of accept it and go with the flow of the movie.
Yeah, exactly. You can't think too hard on it. Just let the movie happen, and it's very entertaining. Like, that scene, my stomach just turned thinking about it. It's extremely disturbing in a great way. It's such a unique scene. I loved it.
But then there's this great other paradox at the end of the movie. So Joe sacrifices himself to ensure that his mother doesn't get killed and the child becomes the Rainmaker. But I mean, Sid, yes, he'll grow up with his mother now and will grow up with love, so maybe he won't become the Rainmaker. But, or will he? I mean, Sid technically thinks that Sarah's sister is his mother, and he continually talks about the rumors of the Rainmaker is that he watched his mother die, which he says he watched his mother die when he accidentally killed her. They also talk about how the Rainmaker has the prosthetic jaw. He still gets shot in the face by Bruce Willis's character, old Joe. So these all still kind of happen. So what if, even though Joe sacrifices himself and kills himself, what if the Rainmaker still comes to fruition and Sid still becomes the Rainmaker? And then also,
that's real dark.
We have this consistency paradox where if you go back in time and kill your younger self, you'll never have existed. So how could the events of the story even take place in general? So again, lots of different like plot holes, but I think Johnson leaves it open-ended with what I just said before that on purpose to make you think.
Yeah, 100%. But I understand that the Rainmaker could still come to fruition, but I think that at the end of the film, Sid does accept that she's his mother, and he always knew, I think, but I think that, because he's a very intelligent little kid, and the actor who played him, like, I don't understand how this little kid can act so well at the age of, like, what, 3, 4?
No, he's like 6, dude.
No way. That kid was like 4 when they made this. He's little. And he's amazing as a child actor, but he is very intelligent. I think that he was denying that she was his mother out of spite because he knows that she left him. And so I think at the end of the film, he accepts that she's his mother because they hug and he calls her mommy. So I think that he won't become the Rainmaker because they finally establish that they're going to have a maternal relationship with one another. And they also get they also get the gold at the end of the film, so she'll be able to provide him with a comfortable life. And she clearly is highly motivated to be as good a mother to him as possible because she feels guilty for abandoning him when he was born to live her life and have fun in the city. And I think that she's motivated to make up for that. And so I think she's going to try to do her best to provide a loving environment for him. and to make Sid use his powers for good in the future. So I don't think the Rainmaker will be created now.
I can see that.
Yeah, but you have a good point.
Overall, though, this is a phenomenal movie, and when you don't think about it too hard, it's very entertaining, really great script, great acting, and some of the visuals are stunning, too, and incredibly disturbing, not just the limbs disappearing, but also when Sid kills the gunman, the Gatman at the farmhouse, and he just hovers him in the air and just, like, disperses the blood out of his body.
Yeah, it's nuts.
So crazy. And so really cool effects, lots of cool concepts, interesting themes, lots of paradoxes, of course, because it's time travel. But overall, I love this movie.
Yeah, this movie's great. And I think this movie is what got Rian Johnson on board to make a Star Wars movie, because it's so good.
Source Code, released in 2011, directed by Duncan Jones, written by Ben Ripley. This film stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Michelle Monaghan, Vera Farmiga, and Jeffrey Wright. With a budget of $32 million, this film had a worldwide box office of $147 million. A soldier wakes up in someone else's body and discovers he's part of an experimental government program to find the bomber of a commuter train within 8 minutes.
I adore this movie. It's got a brilliant script and a great story. And it's a very small movie. It's just set on one location for the most part. And Jake Gyllenhaal carries the film. And it's a showcase to his ability to be a great actor, but also handle action in special effects and sci-fi. And Duncan Jones proved himself, because Moon was great, but not that many people saw Moon. I think it made like $7 million. And then with Source Code, he finally got a big budget, and he had a big movie star to work with. And they crafted an amazing movie, and it made almost $200 million. So it was a big hit. And I think they knocked it out of the park with this. It's a really fun take on the idea of simulations, the idea of multiverses, and also, if you're a fan of video games, this movie is like, it's kind of like watching a video game.
Yeah, in a way. And Duncan Jones, incredibly talented young director, son of David Bowie, we've talked about on our other podcasts. This movie, it's a great blend of mystery, suspense, science fiction. Again, we're dealing with themes of not really time travel, sort of say, but alternate realities, virtual realities. Jake's character, Coulter, one of the strengths of the film is he's entirely clueless to what's going on, just like the audience as we watch it. And Jake brings this vulnerability to the character, so we feel immensely for him. And the first time the bomb goes off, we experience that with him too. And
what's great is we think it's real the first time.
Yeah, so there are a lot of emotional scenes in this movie of this character, Coulter. And like him, we're trying to answer these questions. Why am I here? Who put me here? What am I here for? Is this real? Why am I on this plane? Why when I look in the mirror, there's another man's face and not mine? And so Coulter deals with a lot of emotions in this film.
He has to accept the fact that his body is nearly dead and it's on life support, and there's no way he will ever live a normal life again, because the setup of this film is that he was an Air Force pilot who crashed and his body was completely destroyed. And the army, the military, put him on life support, and they entered his mind into the simulation program. And the simulation program is designed in order to prevent terrorist attacks from happening by investigating past attacks. So, for example, in this film, a series of terrorist attacks are being carried out, and the first one happened on a train, and they want to stop another one from happening because, based on their intel, there's going to be more attacks on the city. And they're able to use this person's last 8 minutes of memories to reconstruct the scene of the crime. And so it's like a kind of like a whodunit mystery in a simulation. And Coulter has 8 minutes each time to try and figure out either a new clue or who the bomber actually is, so that he can provide intel to the military superiors so that they can stop the next attack from happening.
Yeah, so he's in this body of this man named Sean Fentress, who's a teacher. And the each time he's put back into Source Code, he opens up talking to this woman who he's never met before, Christina, played by Michelle Monaghan. And each time we're put back into Source Code, we make it a little further, just like a video game where we're trying to figure things out, figure out the level. And but also throughout his mission that he is forced to accept, he's developing feelings for this woman, Christina, and he's really starting to like her. But he's also dealing with a lot of guilt of his past, where Coulter left his family to grieve for his death, and the last conversation he had with his father was a fight. And he actually, while in the program, while in Source Code, as Sean Fentress, uses a cell phone to call home and communicate with them, and he calls his father, and it's a really emotional scene where his father answers, and Coulter obviously pretends to be Fentress, and his father explains that all that came back of his son was ash, despite him actually still being alive. And it's really powerful because Coulter tells him that, you know, he died with his, he was there when his son died, and he just wanted him to know that he loved him and that he was sorry. And
but this is important because it's kind of a hint to what the eventuality of the simulation is doing. Because when I first saw this movie, when he made the phone call to his father, I was thinking, oh, he's calling his father in the real world,
yeah,
from within the simulation. But what we find out is that each new version of the source code is creating its own universe, its own alternate reality. And so a multiverse is being created through this program. And so when Coulter called his father, he wasn't talking to his father in the real world. He was talking to the version of his father in this dimension, this alternate reality that the source code has created. And at first, we and Coulter think that this is just an 8-minute loop and that's it. There's nothing beyond that, because at the end of each 8 minutes, the train blows up and he fails every time. So it seems as though that's the end of the program. There's nothing beyond that. But we find out that at the end, when he finally stops the train and stops the explosion from happening, it doesn't stop. The simulation keeps carrying on, because what happened is the simulation, every time it is turned on, it creates its own alternate reality. And so this multiverse has been created now.
And Vera Farmiga's character, Goodwin, she's also dealing with her own personal moral crisis, where she has a job to do. She works for this organization. She works for Source Code. But at what cost is she doing this job? They're trying to save lives, yes, but they're exploiting the life of another human being. Is it moral? Is it ethical? And during that scene when Sean calls his father, Goodwin opens up the chamber that Coulter's real body is in, and he's just half a human physically, and he's in a vegetative state, and you see what they've turned him into. He's essentially a computer part. He's a biotech slave to Source Code, and he's used like a tool at the will of his programmers. And to actually see his face and see his body, this really changes Goodwin's perception of the program and the job she's doing there. And this helps her to decide to help Coulter, to help him live through that 8 minutes and see what happens. And it's really cool, because when he and Christina kiss, and time kind of freezes in Source Code for a couple seconds, but then it starts to keep going because the simulation's like, oh, we're not over.
Yeah.
Because like you said, it's creating a new universe.
Yeah, it's a great point. And because on top of that, Goodwin is struggling with the fact that Rutledge, played by Jeffrey Wright, her superior, once Colton figured out who the bomber was, he wants to reset Coulter's mind and put him into another simulation in the future. And so he wants to put Coulter through the simulations over and over and over again and use him as a tool indefinitely, which is just an inhumane way to treat a person. And so Goodwin, after empathizing with Coulter enough by speaking with him and communicating with him so often, she decides to make that move and alter the course of Rutledge's plan in favor of Coulter.
And then it's so fascinating what happens at the end of the film after he succeeds and stops the bomber, and we're progressing past eight minutes into this new world, and him and Christina go to the Millennium Park, and he sends this really cool text message to Goodwin. He sends this text message to Goodwin, which she receives before the mission even starts, before he gets put even into Source Code, telling her that you helped. There's a Captain Coulter who is going to be put into Source Code today. You helped him. You helped avert a mission. Source Code works better than anyone could have imagined. And it's really interesting where she doesn't tell Jeffrey Wright's character, her superior officer, what happened and how they actually prevented this explosion from happening, but because it was in a different reality, in a different universe.
And that begs the question, maybe that already happened and they didn't show it. Before this Coulter, there was another Coulter in a different simulation before this movie who texted Goodwin, and we just didn't see it shown on camera. And then the events played out like that. So maybe this has happened many times. Maybe this could have happened infinite number of times.
Yeah,
and over and over and over and over again.
The cool thing about it is Stevens, Coulter is now split into two separate places at the same time, technically, because he's got his body at Source Code headquarters in that little chamber, but he's also, his consciousness is inside the body of Sean Fentress in this new version of reality in that Source Code that exceeded the 8 minutes. But there's also a Sean Fentress that survived, I'm sure, and that's living his life somewhere else too. And on a separate reality, he's probably living out a life as well.
So there, I think there are infinite simulations of source code with this exact thing playing out over and over again. I think that's what's so cool when you think about this movie, because the possibilities are endless with this.
So this movie really makes you think, and again, maybe not as many paradoxes as Looper, but also the technology is ridiculous, but and I just got to accept it. As long as the technology, it tells the story in a really effective way for me when I'm dealing with a sci-fi movie like this, where obviously this is impossible, but if it tells a story effectively, then I completely accept it. I have no problem at all.
Yeah, and I love when the scope of movies like this are small, where the plot of the movie just takes place on this train, and it's all about figuring out how to stop the explosion. That's it. No end of the world, no gigantic global disaster. It's just real small and real simple, and I love that about this film, and I think that's why it works so well, because it's very high concept ideas, but told in a very simple way.
A really cool fun fact about the filming of this movie is that while filming scenes, Jake Gyllenhaal had an earbud in during train sequences, into which director Duncan Jones would start playing music at different points of time or make him disoriented with random songs and static buzz to help the character become disoriented. And Jake Gyllenhaal was actually the one who suggested Duncan Jones direct this movie after seeing Moon, which was a phenomenal movie, and obviously Jake Gyllenhaal really liked it.
These are four amazing science fiction films, and science fiction, the genre, has elevated every decade, and the movies just get better, and the ideas in these films get deeper. And I think ultimately all these films talk about eventually the same idea, which is humanity and what it means to be human. And I think that the use of technology or alien life or time travel can be used as a way to think about life and think about what it's like to be human.
And that's it for episode 55 of Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you for watching Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Hit that subscribe button and notification bell. Listen to the audio formats of Raiders of the Lost Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes every Monday and Thursday. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast.